Okay, so we'll start with a bit of motivation first. So algebras are a sort of reasonably well-known tool within the computer science community, or at least the theoretical computer science community. And, well, the features of them are that basically they can be considered as modeling systems with abstract state and an interface for making observations on that state and maybe updating it, and then some dynamics connecting the two together. Well, at least very crudely, that sounds like a situation that would be of interest in physics, particularly if you're of an operationalist leaning. So that's what we're going to have a look at today. So basic idea is to consider co-algebras as ways of modeling some physical systems. So we'll start with a very broad sense of physical systems, and we'll get down to quantum systems eventually. And the theory of co-algebra is basically every coalgebra comes with a way of generating a sort of natural form of logic that goes with it. And that's quite a nice tool for then making abstract statements about the systems that you're modeling and maybe getting connections with general purpose tools and that type of thing. And this is a relatively new area. There are some papers by myself, Samson Abramsky, Yoshihiro Maruyama, and there's some work going on at Nijmegen, but there's not a whole mass of material in this area, so there's quite a lot of scope for innovation and doing new and interesting things. Okay, so given that that's the sort of plan of attack, the way we're going to go about it is I'm going to spend quite a lot of time here on this first part outlining what coalgebras are. I'm not going to make any assumptions that you know anything about what a coalgebra is in advance. And I'm going to outline some of the background category theory as well. So for some of you that might be a bit basic, but at least fix notation, and it should fix some of the basic ideas that we're going to use to build stuff up later on. So mainly what I use as examples will be things we'll build things out of later. And then we're going to get to something a little bit more concrete, which is a representation result for the unitary group in a algebraic setting. So that extends some work of Samson Abramsky, or actually rather simplifies it from what was originally quite technically a complicated result into quite a simple result. Then we're going to have a look at these logics that we can generate for coalgebras. And again, we're going to apply that to quantum systems. And it's going to happen again that we need to innovate a little bit there to incorporate the unitaries. So there'll be a little bit of new material there. And the basic plan is to do lots of examples. So it's going to be examples all the way and hopefully a minimum of really formal stuff. And in line with that, if I say something that's just meaningless or not clear, just stop me and I'll hopefully try and clarify and make it a bit less meaningless, although jet lag may kick in at some point. Okay, so really basic stuff to start off with, definition of a category. It has a big class or collection of things we call objects. So in this pretty picture here, these are sort of endpoints, these guys. For each pair of these things, there's a collection of morphisms, which we also just call arrows with this rather suggestive notation, and there's a composition operation. So if you have an arrow F going from A to B and an arrow G going from B to C, then you can form a composite, which you read this dot here as after, then that's G after F is probably the easiest way to read that guy if you've not seen it before. We also have identities for each object, which then all behaves in the obvious way. So composition order is associative. And the identities act as you would expect the act as identities with respect to the composition. Okay, so loads of examples. The sort of the canonical example, I suppose, is the category of sets and total functions between them. So the sets are going to be the objects, the total functions, the arrows are the morphisms. That's going to be the main guy we're interested in later on, so we're going to denote that as set. That'll crop up again and again. But there's lots of other things we can do of a similar type. So we can have sets and partial functions, sets and binary relations between them, partially ordered sets and monotone functions, and lots of variants on that, such as lattices, meet semi-lattices, DCPOs, and Scott continuous functions. Similarly, we can have topological spaces and the continuous functions between them, or metric spaces, or compact Hausdorff spaces, lots of variants along that line as well. And then there are lots and lots of algebraic examples. So we take groups and group homomorphisms, monoids and monoid homomorphisms, vector spaces, and so on and so forth. So these guys, I've called this slide objects and their transformation. So basically the objects here are all sets of stuff with probably some extra structure. and the morphisms are then things that preserve the interesting structure in some way. But not all examples have to be of that type. So if we consider a partially ordered set, so ABC with some ordering relation, we can draw that with arrows, meaning B is greater than A and C is greater than A, and these two aren't ordered with respect to each other. And if we added a few identities, which I've skipped because they don't really add anything, then we can use a category to describe a partially ordered set in that way. And similarly, for a group or a monoid, we can take a collection of things, could be a curly bracket there that's gone AWOL, with a multiplication and a unit, and we can represent that as a one-object category with morphisms for each of the elements of the group. The composition is handled by the arrow composition, and then if we just make it that these guys are inverse to each other, then we get the group rather than the monoid. Okay, so next basic building block we're going to be dealing with. Functors are basically maps between categories. So they consist of the following parts. A map between the objects in the source category to the objects in the target category. For each morphism, we get a morphism in the target category, so in a type-respecting way. They preserve identities, and they preserve the composition axiom. So they basically preserve the structure of a category as they transfer it across from one side to the other. Okay, so what that basically means is, if, for example, we have an equality here between some compositions of morphisms in a category, then functors preserve equalities, which we'll need later on. Or put even possibly more simply, if we say that this diagram commutes, then if we apply our functor F everywhere, then it still commutes. That's basically what functorality is getting you. Okay, so some examples of functors. We'll need some of these guys later on. So the identity functor is obviously a functor, so you just map everything to itself. Constant functors, so there's a little bit of abusive notation here. So if we take an object D in a category D, curly D, then we can define a functor from some arbitrary category C such that it just takes everything to D and it takes all the morphisms to the identity on that object. So I also call that functor D, basically. So that's a bit of an abusive notation, but hopefully it's clear what's going on. If we consider functors between the partial orders that we saw a couple of slides ago, then they basically boil down to being monotone, so order preserving functions. So they kind of do the right thing. They're preserving the structure that was in there, and it turns out they're the monotone functions, which is what we'd normally consider for these order theoretic structures. Similarly, if we take a functor between a monoid represented as a category, then we get a monoid homomorphism. And if we take one a functor between a group as a category, groups as categories, then we get group homomorphism. So they basically seem to do the right thing in terms of preserving structure. Okay, so we're going to get into a few sort of slightly more interesting functors now. The power set functor is defined in the obvious way, going from set to set. It takes a set X to the set of all of its subsets, and it takes a function to the direct image function, basically. So it's going to take a subset U to all the things that are going to get it's going to get mapped over to. Okay, so we're going to need another sort of variant on the power set construction. So we're going to consider also contravariant functors. So a functor is said to be contravariant if it basically reverses the directions of the arrow. So if we look here, we've got F going from X to Y, G going from Y to Z. If we apply a contravariant functor, then basically we'd stick the Fs everywhere as before, but you'll see the directions of the arrows is flipped, and then obviously the composition order is flipped as well. There's more formal ways of saying that, but from a practical point of view, we just care that it flips the direction of the arrows around. And the sort of canonical example of a contravariant functor, and certainly the one we'll be most interested in, is the contravariant power set functor. So in that case, it's going to take a set to its power set again, and it's going to take a function to the inverse image map between the two power sets. That one guy's going to be of use later on, particularly in the logical part. Okay, so a more probabilistic example, a function from an arbitrary set to the interval 0, 1 is set to have finite support if it's non-zero only in finitely many places. So that's a fairly standard definition. And the finite distribution functor is then another functor on set. So we're basically interested in functors that are going from set to set or something of that ilk. It takes a set to the set of functions going from the set into 0, 1. So those are going to pick out probability such that obviously everything adds up to 1 and that we have finite support. And then the way it acts on morphisms, which are basically functions, is if we map over using an F a particular distribution, you get a new distribution in which the probabilities are given by totting up all the things that get mapped over by the F in a sort of fairly natural way. Okay, so another thing we might be interested in is combining categories together. So this is basically a construction we're just going to need for a couple of slides. So if it's bewildering, then you can probably ignore it. So we take two categories, C and D, then we can glue them together in what would probably be, seem to be the obvious way. We can take as objects, pairs of objects from C and D, and we can take as morphisms going from something CD to C prime D prime as a pair of morphisms, one from C and one from D that have the relevant type. So it's the obvious way of gluing two things together, if I've managed to, in formalizing it, make it sound complicated. And the main reason we're interested in these is it makes these guys bifunctors easier to explain. So a bifunctor is just another sort of functor, except it goes from a product category to somewhere else, basically. So in particular, we're interested in Cartesian products. They're going to be of interest later on when we want to start gluing things together. And they form a bifunctor, so you take a pair of sets to the set of pairs in the obvious way, and you take a pair of functions and make them act so that they map the first component to first component via F and the second component to the second component via the second function. So that's hopefully all fairly obvious. Okay, so disjoint unions also form a bifunctor. So again, we're going to take a pair of sets, but in this case, we're going to glue them together into a disjoint union. So we're just going to tag them with 0 and 1 in the obvious way. Then the action, the behavior of functions is going to behave as follows. So if it's something that sits in the first component, then you map it over by F to something that's still tagged up as being in the first component in the target. And similarly, if you take a pair of components here, you map them over, you apply the second function. In fact, is that right? I'm not sure that's correct. Yes, that is correct. There we go. Okay, so. Right, finally, we want to deal with something which we maybe call exponentials in the category theoretic setting, but we're just interested in basically in sets of functions with a fixed domain A, and that's going to give us a functor of the following form. So we do the obvious thing. For a set X, we take all the functions from A to X as the objects that we're interested in. And for a morphism G, G of A acts by taking a function from A to X, you compose G on the end, and you get a function from A to Y. So G is a function from X to Y, basically. So you just glue those two guys together in the obvious way. Okay, we finally hit coalgebra, so that quick blast through functors and categories has finally paid off, hopefully. So a coalgebra for an endo functor, so that's just a functor with the same domain and codomain, is a pair. So it consists of an object living within the category that we're working in, and then a morphism of a very particular sort of regular form. So it takes an object as its domain, and then the codomain is going to be T of X, so it's quite a regular form of thing. So the reason for the name coalgebra is this dualizes a categorical notion of algebra, which in turn extends the normal definition of what you might consider an algebra in the sort of real world. So it's algebra is generalized and then flipped around, so they're running backwards, as tends to happen quite a lot in category theory. So when we reason about these things, sort of typical line of thinking in computer science is to think of X as, well, if we're working with sets, we think of it as a set of abstract states, but if in an arbitrary category, it's an object of abstract states in some sense. The endo functor is basically structuring things, so it gives us a structure on the codomain of what we consider sort of observations we can make on how this thing is operating. And the morphism is what's referred to as the dynamics, and that basically just connects the two. So it takes states to the observations that you're going to be able to make in that state. We're mainly going to work in the category set, so this is just going to be a function of a particular form, a very regular type of function. But we, if we varied the base category, we could get behavior that was continuous or linear or order preserving or various other interesting things. So that's the reason to sort of use this category theoretic language rather than just describe everything as a sort of concrete theory in terms of sets and functions. Okay, so we're going to consider coalgebras for the identity functor first. So in a way, what could be easier? So a coalgebra for the identity functor, it's just a function going from x to x. But there is something interesting to observe here. I mean, what this thing really can do, all it can do is take something in x, bung it somewhere else in x, and we can do that again and again and again and again and again and again and so on. And there's not really anything else that can happen. And if we pick another state, then it can't do anything else either. So it's going to again and again and again and again, it can just keep changing state. So really what I'm trying to say here is because we're only sticking the identity functor on the right-hand side, there's no interesting observations that we can make. So every state is the same from an observational point of view. We really can't tell them apart. And so these coalgebras are sort of maximally boring in some sense. And we'll make that a bit more precise later on what the boringness might mean mathematically. But really, there's not a lot that can go on. And the other thing I'm going to try and emphasize in this talk is you can, with thinking of this coalgebra as describing a particular type of directed graph here, or at least a part of it. And that's a line of thinking that we're going to pursue throughout. So in a way, you can think of these coalgebras as generalizations of directed graphs. Okay, so we're going to make things slightly more interesting. So we're now going to consider coalgebras of the form where they take some set of states x to either another state in x or some special state star, which we'll think of as the process dying. So it's evolved for some time and then it's dropped dead. So really, there's only sort of two things that can happen. You can either evolve, live forever, or you can eventually drop dead. So those are the two sort of distinct classes of behavior. And then within the guys that drop dead, then you can distinguish those guys by how long they've got left before they're eventually going to drop dead. So this guy's going to die in three steps, but this guy, y double prime, is going to die in a step. So those guys are behaviorally equivalent. If you prod them a few times, they'll eventually drop dead. Yep. Yes, so it's, you make a choice of objects in the base category. So we're going to choose a set. So the sets. So this would be, if we think of these guys as graphs, we're going to pick x as the labels for our vertices, effectively. And then we're going to choose a function that describes the structure of this graph, which is of the form of a coalgebra. Does that make sense?
So
it's
only one object.
So you choose one object, but then you would have a category consisting of all the possible different T coalgebras. There's obviously lots of different, so we could choose another Y here and get another coalgebra of a similar form. And we could actually get different coalgebras for the same base set by varying this gamma as well. So there's lots of choice you can make as to which coalgebra you're going to generate. There isn't one per category or one per functor or even one per set. You can vary the dynamics and you can vary the base set. There's going to be lots more examples, so hopefully it'll become clear what we can do by varying these things.
What's the functor here?
So the functor here is the coproduct or disjoint union functor that we saw several slides ago, and then a constant combined with a constant functor. So we're setting that guy to be constantly the star set on the left-hand side. So it's just a gluing together of a couple of the standard functors that we saw earlier, a particular constant one. And we'll be interested in this one quite a lot because it's quite handy to have a sort of a dead state or a no can do state or whatever. So that's a fairly standard thing that we're going to be doing. And the plus generally is going to indicate some sort of choice as to what can go on. So even if you're not quite clear what the functor is that we're building, basically we've got a choice here between dropping dead and carrying on behaving as if we're a normal state. Okay, so making things slightly more interesting, again, we're going to consider coalgebras for the power set functor. And that's going to give us a model of non-determinism. So if we think of some x, so that's a member of this set x, then we can think of the states that that gets mapped to by the dynamics as being a sort of non-deterministic choice as to where it's going to evolve to next. And that's what this graph's intending to describe. And obviously, it could evolve to nowhere, so we could see it making no progress, or we can see it making progress to another state where it can continue to make progress. And we'll examine in a bit more detail later what that might mean from the point of view of differentiated behaviors on these guys by sort of inspecting what we can observe about them. And in terms of this power set here, this is a sort of arbitrarily branching graph, so that's a pretty sort of out of control thing. You've got an awful lot of non-determinism. You can bound this guy, for instance, taking finite power sets or various other functors to constrain the guy so it doesn't behave quite so unusually. Okay, so this is a variant on the previous example. So we're going to use the power set functor again to give non-determinism. But this time, we're going to consider a set of labels sigma as well. So this then basically gives us a graph where we have multiple transitions coming out of each state, and they're labeled. So it's as if you've got a box, and you can press the A button, or the B button, or the C button. And when you press one of those buttons, it's going to move to some other state or states where possibly there might be no states it evolves to. So each button leads to different behavior. So these guys in computer science are called labeled transition systems, and it's basically a label-directed graph. So again, everything basically looks like a directed graph of some generalized form. Okay, and then we saw this guy, the finite distribution functor earlier. That, again, is a sort of a labeled graph, but there's some constraints on the behavior. So we start in the state x. There's a probability of it jumping to w, probability of it jumping to y. Obviously, they sum to 1, and 1 is a sort of constraint versus the arbitrary labeled transitions we saw previously. And that gives us a graph with basically movements out of each state as probability labeled transitions. So that would allow us in computer science in sort of obvious way to model probabilistic behavior. Okay, so finally we've got to a slide with quantum in the title, so it sounds like vaguely proper physics. This is a model that came from the Abramsky paper, which was sort of the start of my interest in these things. So the idea is to model a quantum system as a sort of a question and answer system. So we consider the projection operators on some choice of Hilbert space. So we're making a choice, like the question came earlier. We're going to choose an actual size of Hilbert space that we're interested in. And that's actually going to fix the functor we're going to use. And then we're going to define a functor as follows. So we're working with sets, so everything's still in set. We haven't moved to some linear setting or something that you might think might creep in when we start talking about Hilbert spaces. We're still dealing with just sets of things going to sets of things. And our signature, the basic idea is that we're going to operate as follows. We consider a projection operator to be sort of a question that we can ask of our system. And then when we ask that question, it's probabilistic as to how the answer is going to come out. So we either get a probability of making a particular transition and then the subsequent state, or we get told no can do. There's no possibility of a positive answer to that question. And I suppose I should comment that this is it's neither the most specific nor the most general purpose model of a quantum systems that you could consider. As for instance, we're assuming here that we know that we're going to transition to a particular state. We're given the transition we're going to make. We know the subsequent state. You could consider models where that wasn't the case. And we're going to consider a different model later on built on the finite distribution functor, which has different features and is more convenient for constructing logics, which we're going to do later on. Yep.
Why have you excluded probability zero? I would imagine that some states are...
Well, if you imagine you're in some state and you take a sort of a projective measurement, and if you're in a state where there's just no possibility, you know, so it's orthogonal to the relevant subspace, then... Well, you could say that it had probability zero here, but then you've got the question about what subsequent state do you say it would have moved into, and you have to model that sensibly. So instead, we dodge that by not considering zero, and instead saying no can do by labeling it with this star state. So in the case where you can't do it, the harder question is just what to say about what the subsequent state would be, because there isn't really a subsequent state. It's not a very well-defined question.
Okay.
Okay, so this is hopefully reasonably obvious. This is the coalgebra we would use to model a quantum system. So again, as we mentioned earlier, we've got lots of choices to the actual choice of dynamics that we could go for. So we could imagine lots of other things we could model with this signature. So we might consider systems with sort of super quantum properties, or we might consider ones where they're weaker than quantum systems. But for the quantum case, I've put square brackets in here at the moment because we're going to consider projective Hilbert space. So these guys are basically rays. I'll drop the square brackets later on because otherwise this gets rather ugly and I'm not sure it's particularly helpful. But it does then the obvious thing. It takes some state. We work out whether there's any chance of a successful measurement, in which case we calculate the subsequent state and the probability, and that's the outcome that we're going to give. So that was hopefully fairly obvious from the structure of the function we were considering. And as we mentioned, if there's no probability of a successful measurement, then we go to the no-can-do state, as this star state is now denoting. Okay, so now we're going to consider probably the most important notion when considering coalgebras, which is this notion of bisimilarity. So that is at least one of the ways of formalizing that things are observationally the same. So if you kept prodding them forever and observing the outcomes, you'd never be able to tell them apart. Those are bisimilar things, and we try and formalize that mathematically. So the very formal way of describing it is to take a binary relation, so a relationship between two sets of states. So we're working in set here, so you could generalize these notions, but we're just going to consider coalgebras on set. And this relationship is a bisimulation if this diagram commutes. So these guys are the projections projecting out x and y from the binary relation in the obvious way. We just take the binary relation as a set and apply our signature functor to it to get the structure of this guy. And then if we can find a coalgebra structure that fills in here such that this commutes, then R is a bisimulation. And hopefully, if the details of this picture aren't 100% clear immediately, the basic idea is that our relation respects the coalgebra transition structure in some way. So it's sort of capturing that the way these things evolve are going to evolve similar. X and Y are going to evolve in similar ways from the point of view of the dynamics. And then two states are said to be bisimilar if you can find a bisimulation between them. So those are guys that are observationally equivalent, effectively. They're going to do the same thing no matter how you prod the system. That's the informal intuition for these guys, is that bisimilar states are observationally equivalent. If you go to the coalgebra literature, if you should decide to do so afterwards, there's several different notions of bisimulation, which often collapse down to the same thing in all the cases you're interested in. But do be aware that there's more than one notion of bisimilarity out there. There's also another notion called behavioral equivalence, which again collapses down to what I've described as bisimilarity here in almost every case you would probably be interested in. But if you see different definitions, there are cases where the two can diverge. So I've been a bit free and loose with terms like observationally equivalent and bisimilar. And I could be a bit more precise if I wanted to be fiddly about it.
Is it the case that the functor T determines gamma x and gamma y? No,
so gamma x and gamma y. So we've started with two coalgebras here. So these are maybe this is a model of our quantum system, for instance. And then, well, to keep things simple, maybe this is also the same model of our quantum system, if we're going to think of that particular example. Then we want to say that two states are bisimilar. So basically, if we do projective measurements on them, we're never going to be able to tell them apart. And in order to do that, we set some relationship up between states in X and Y. So it might not be every state, but just some subset of the states, such that this diagram commutes. So the guy that we're really trying to find, and it can be difficult to find it, is this gamma R in the middle. It basically says that we can sort of compatibly move these guys down so that they're always going to behave in the same way. So these guys are sort of givens. They're saying, oh, well, I have a model of a quantum system, and I think the dynamics work like this. I now want to be able to argue that two states are observationally the same. And in order to do that, I find some dynamics such that this diagram commutes, which basically means they travel down this middle section here sort of compatibly, and then you can have a look at them or you can go straight to considering them on the two sets of dynamics that you're interested in, see how they evolve, and they're going to end up basically in the, sort of the same place that you related by this relation in the middle. So yeah, the game is to find one of these guys that relates them, basically.
How this is an equivalence relation. So
it isn't necessarily, but I in the most sensible technical circumstances, you can close it to an equivalence relation, but it doesn't need to be. So you just need to relate enough stuff that you can demonstrate that, you know, you want to say that your two states are related, but in order to do that, you need to also have them be related sort of at the next step. So that kind of grows the relationship that you need to consider. So you may originally, if you're going to do this iteratively, you may say, right, these are two states that I want to show are bisimilar. I'm pretty sure that they are because I know the situation I'm modeling. Okay, I then need to construct this setup. You quickly find that where these guys step to next, you also need those guys to be related. So again, you have to add another pair of states to your relation. And you basically do that until they either loop back round or they sort of find themselves in some sort of stable setup. And that basically says that this set are going to behave the same all the way through.
I think the point I was missing was just what tells me that gamma x and gamma y evolve the states in the same way. So you're sort of defining x and y to be bisimilar if they have the same observable behavior.
Yeah.
But I guess I wonder about, you know, a map gamma r that could sort of evolve x in one way and y in another way, and then I can still pull out those evolved x and y's from
I think I can sort of maybe see your point that, yeah, I could maybe do something naughty in here, but it turns out technically if you were to unwind this, I'm going to unwind a few examples in a minute and see what this constraint actually means on some concrete cases. But it basically does do the right thing. It's only going to relate things that are observationally equivalent or it seems to do the right thing, basically. So I'll maybe get to the examples, and then if it's still not clear, then you can pull me up again and I can try and explain myself again. Okay, so these are the examples, in fact. So for the identity functor, which we said was farcically boring, and we can make that precise now, that if we take any two states within two coalgebras on the identity functor, then they're always bisimilar. So everything's the same. It just moves and moves and moves and moves and moves and moves, and nothing exciting happens. So everything's bisimilar to everything else in that case. For the deterministic system we modeled, where basically you could either keep moving or you die, we'll use some notation that's fairly common here. This basically says that under the dynamics, X moves to star in its next move. So in one step, it's going to move to the dead state. And in order to be bisimilar, this condition must hold. So if X moves to the dead state, then Y must move to the dead state as well. And if X moves to some other state, X prime, and y moves to some other state, y prime, then those two must be bisimilar. So this is this thing where you have to sort of close under the steps that you're making in order to get a relation that fully demonstrates that the things are bisimilar. For the labeled transition systems, which are the sort of canonical example of these guys, and the notion of bisimilarity there originates, I think, in the concurrency literature. The basic idea is if x can make a transition to x prime when you press the A button, then there exists a Y prime such that Y can make a transition via A to Y prime, and the subsequent states are bisimilar. So it basically says you can. It's an existential here. But this is universally quantified on the outside, but it basically says you can find something that could lead to you not being able to tell them apart, basically. So this existential says there is a way that this guy can sneak through and continue to pretend to be the same. And clause one here would be what would be called a simulation, because it says that one guy can pretend to be the other, and then we consider the symmetrical condition in condition two. So that basically says now that y can make a move to y prime, and in that case, then there is an x prime such that x can make a move, and the two are bisimilar. So that's the sort of the mirror condition. Then it basically says you can't tell the two apart from either side. The two basically behave the same all the way through. And in the case of our quantum coalgebra, each state lives in a distinct bisimilarity class. So each ray, if you take two different rays, you can tell them apart by making appropriate projective measurements. So each ray is in a distinct bisimilarity class. That's a result from Abramsky, where he makes that precise rather than my informal argument. And that's a property which is referred to as strong extensionality, and we're going to need that later when we get onto something a bit more technical.
So each of these corresponds to that commutative.
Yeah, exactly. All of those are this guy unwound for a particular signature functor. So it's not actually that hard to unwind these things. It's a bit harder for this one because it's a bit of a richer thing. But yeah, these guys are. I did the job a couple of days ago and unwound them, and yeah, you derive them directly from this thing. So they and this notion here of bisimilarity in the case of label transition systems that predates the notion of coalgebra really in terms of modeling systems in computer science. And when they then came to unwind this definition, we find, like we were questioning earlier, maybe that it does do the right thing. They found the notion of similarity that they cooked up by hand when they were wondering about how these label transitions should be compared from the point of view of sort of observational equivalence. Okay, so the next thing we want to consider is how coalgebras transform. So if we've got a coalgebra X and gamma X and another one Y and gamma Y, then a morphism between them is a morphism, so a function in all the cases that we're considering. So it's a function from X to Y of these guys are sets, such that this diagram commutes. So it's encoding a notion of compatibility between the two structures. If you're used to category theory, this is a sort of obvious diagram you would write down for the category theoretic definition of obvious, but you basically glue together things in a type theoretic way that tends to capture that you're preserving the right structure. And then once you've considered that these are probably the correct notion of morphism to consider, then we notice something that's quite interesting, that these coalgebra homomorphisms, they preserve bisimilarity. So if we take some state here, we've no choice but to map it to another one over here, which is observationally equivalent to it, basically. So we can't start mapping things to arbitrary things. They're going to have to behave in the same way. Okay, so now we're going to get onto the, as promised, attempt to model unitary transformations in the coalgebraic setting. So we've got our quantum coalgebra that we've cooked up that looks fairly natural using the Hilbert space formalism, basically. And then what we might expect to find for the unitaries is that they're going to appear as automorphisms of this quantum coalgebra. So they're going to be maps from that coalgebra to itself. It seems quite a natural thing to expect. But we've made a couple of conflicting observations, we could make an obvious observation here, is that if we evolve the state of a physical system, we sort of fully expect that after we've evolved it, the observable behavior would change. That seems intuitively fairly obvious. And that's what the unitaries are doing for us. Basically, they're evolving the state of the system, so we'd expect the observable behavior to change. And as we noted on the previous slide, the coalgebra homomorphisms preserve bisimilarity. So you can't do this. You can't map a state to something with different observable behavior. So we've hit a bit of a difficulty that we're going to need to resolve, and that we can't model things this way naively because there's only going to be one of these guys, effectively, because we can't map something to something that behaves in a different way, which is exactly what we want to do from a physical point of view. So we're going to have to look at a little bit more technical material before we can come back and sort this problem out in a manner that's fairly close, actually, to this picture with just a slight change of setting. Okay, so the third standard gadget that you encounter in a category theoretic setting are natural transformations. So we've seen functors. Functors are transformations that take you from one category to another. A natural transformation is the next step along. That is a map between two functors. So the functors have to be of the same type, so you can't do this in a willy-nilly manner. So we've got a pair of functors going C to D. A natural transformation is going to be a map between the two. And concretely, what these guys actually are a family of morphisms in the target category, so in D, satisfying a compatibility condition, which is basically that all diagrams of this form commute. So either we can travel along a morphism from the family we've got, the one indexed to X, and then go down G of H for some H that takes us from X to Y, or we could have gone down the other side over here. And that's again, kind of capturing the idea that these natural transformations preserve the the structure present in a functor, although it's slightly less obvious to see possibly than what functors were doing earlier. And these little naturality squares are going to be important later. They help us build things up in various ways that are quite easy to do. Okay, so some examples of natural transformations. If we take the identity functor, then if you take all the identity maps, they basically give you a natural transformation in a rather degenerate and boring way. And I'm fairly sure, although I haven't looked it up, that they're probably the only natural transformations of that type. Andreas can correct me if I'm saying something horribly wrong, but I'm pretty sure that that's the case. And hopefully it'll be obvious why I at least believe that in a second. So if we take instead a natural transformation going from the identity functor on sets to the power set functor, then here's an example. You do the only thing really that you think you could do. You take a member of some set, so these guys over here are sets, and you take a member of the set, and you build a singleton, because you've got to build some sort of set, and it's not very obvious what else you could do. I mean, you could do something nuts, but you're not allowed to do nuts stuff, basically, is what naturality says. So you're not allowed to build a set X with another member, Dan, because that naturality condition will fail. So really what naturality says is you're not allowed to do ad hoc stuff. You're not allowed to cook up things that you weren't really given in the input. You're only really allowed to use the structure of the functors that you're given, which is why you can't really do very much with the identity functor. There's not much structure to play with, so you're really stuck with just copying stuff across. In the case of the power set functor, you can build singletons, so that's the most obvious thing to do in that case. If we take the power set functor composed with itself and take a map to the power set functor, then you do the obvious thing you can do. You do under those circumstances. You've got a set of sets. You take the union of those guys, and that's going to give you another set, and that gives you a map where, again, there's no special cases. There's nothing saying if this set contains A, B, and Andreas, then we do something complicated. That wouldn't be natural. So natural transformations basically capture this sort of uniformity condition. And finally, just another example here is if you've got the constant functor, and this goes another way of writing the identity going to the identity, then again, really the only thing you can do is sort of project out the X. You can't do anything fancy. So again, you're very constrained as to what you can do with these natural transformations. And that's what I'm trying to hammer home at the bottom here is you can't do wacky stuff. You can't have special cases for arbitrary values. You can't manufacture values. You can just use the structure and take things out of pairs, say, or stick things into disjoint unions on the left or the right, but you can't start magicking values out of the air. So these guys are very uniform in their behavior. Okay, so back to a quick mention of quantum theoretic ideas. If we think about a sort of Schrodinger-style evolution of the states of a quantum system, then sort of hammering this home, this is really from a sort of co-algebraic perspective, we will see that the states are going to change. This is sort of obvious from the physics point of view. And the observations are going to remain fixed, so we're going to have the same functor on the right-hand side. And we do the obvious thing, basically. I've dropped the square brackets now, so these are still rays, and we've not got rid of dealing with rays, really. So you just apply the unitary. So by definition, this is an operation on a specific state space, so really it only applies to particular coalgebras. You can't apply it uniformly to all coalgebras on the signature functor that we were interested in. It's very specific to coalgebras with the appropriate state space. They've got to be these rays. If you were just given some arbitrary set with A, B, and C in it, then what on earth would this mean? It applies to a specific state set. And we note from the observations that we made earlier that this is not going to be a coalgebra homomorphism because it's mapping a state into a new state that's going to be observationally different to where it started. So we're going to be able to tell them apart. And we know that these homomorphisms can't do that because you can't move between bisimilarity classes along one of those guys. So we know this guy isn't in itself a homomorphism, except obviously if you use the identity. Okay, so instead we could adopt a Heisenberg perspective on these things. And now what we're going to do is we're going to consider a setting in which we're going to leave the states fixed and we're going to mess around with the observations in the coalgebraic sense that we can make on the system. So we've got an obvious way of letting a unitary act on a projection operator here, just by this sort of conjugation type operation. And if we precompose with that, then we get a map between our two quantum signature functors, which Andrea suggested I should have put on this slide, and I'm now sadly regretting that I didn't do. But if you remember, that went from the lattice of projection operators into this either probabilities or failure or success state. So what we're doing is we're saying before we perform our measurement, we're going to twist our projection round to be a different projection and do a different measurement, basically, so sort of Heisenberg-style nobbling of the observations that we're going to make on our system. And these guys here, because we've got this natural transformation, then we can post-compose with that, and it turns out that that gives us a new coalgebra. Well, it just does via obviousness, really. So we can map our coalgebra to a new coalgebra in which we've twisted everything around, so one in which the observations are different. Okay, so we've seen some things, H, which look like the things we want to play with. Those were the sort of Schrodinger style evolution that we were going to make of the state. And we've seen some other guys, some natural transformations that also look kind of like what we want to do. They're a way of evolving the observations so that we get some sort of evolution of our system. So we consider a general setting here in which we take a subgroup of the automorphisms of our signature functor, and we define a category of pseudo-coalgebras. So these are the new morphisms that we're going to consider. So we're still considering coalgebras as our objects, but instead we're weakening the notion of the maps between them so that a diagram of this type has to commute, or equivalently that a diagram of this type commutes. It's a one-line exercise to show that these two conditions are equivalent. So basically the idea is, if we think of the coalgebraic setting, we can map the states by Schrodinger evolution and then look at the dynamics, or we can apply the dynamics and then twizzle things around using this evolution of the unitaries and then travel across, and we get something that's going to commute. And we'll see that formally is going to work out in a second. I'm just trying to give motivation at this stage as to why we would consider a notion like this. Okay, so, right, I've drawn this diagram vertically, which I think is an audience confuser, but it's the only way to fit it in conveniently onto this slide. So the idea is now we've got a homomorphism like we saw drawn horizontally on this slide, and I've drawn it vertically just to fit the guy in, unfortunately, so it may be a tad confusing. But the idea is this is our quantum coalgebra that we discussed earlier, and we're going to consider the maps induced by the unitaries that did the Schrodinger-style movement of the states, and then we're going to insert a corresponding natural transformation that does a reverse. So this is the one from the inverse of the unitary that we're considering. And it turns out that basically we're Schrodinger evolving in one direction, Heisenberg evolving in the other direction, and via sort of physics-style covariance, these two guys cancel out, and diagrams of this type commute. It's a straightforward chase to do it without a sort of intuitive argument as well. It's fairly easy to check. So that means we've now got, remember this is from our from the point of view of our category pseudo-coalgebra, this is a morphism from gamma q to gamma q again. So it's an automorphism of that guy. Now, each of these HUs is distinct for each equivalence class of unitaries if we quotient out phases via Wigner's theorem. So we get a distinct one of these for each equivalence class of unitaries that we might be interested in. So we've got at least all the unitaries in here. And then because of this strong extensionality property that we mentioned earlier, which was shown in Samson-Abramsky's paper, there's really nothing else we can do, because there's only really one choice of bijection that we can make between a strongly extensional coalgebra and this guy, then we could see as another strongly extensional coalgebra. So basically we've got a full and faithful representation of the unitary group via this twist one thing one way and twist the other thing the other way, basically. So we've got our representation result back that we wanted, where we've got automorphisms of our quantum coalgebra by weakening the morphisms to a freer setting. And one thing I should mention at this point is, if instead we'd taken, instead of the unitaries, we considered the unitaries and anti-unitaries together, a semi-unitary group, then we could broaden the class of natural transformations that we're considering. So that would be this group G of natural transformations. And it then works out that we get a representation of the projective semi-unitary group. So by loosening the group G, you can vary your representation result and pull in more stuff, so that it's a fairly flexible setting in which to work with these things. And this is a result of mine, but there's a previous result by Samson Abramsky that produces the same representation result nominally, but it involves index categories and then converting those index categories to a fibration, then relating that fibration to another fibration of things called two spaces, then finding a fibered functor between the two, and then transferring a representation result from the two space setting to the algebraic setting. So that was quite a complicated paper, rather a nice paper. It's the reason I started on this stuff. But this is really quite simple. It basically just we twist it one way and we untwist it the other way, and hopefully it's more easily motivated than this more existential result of Samson's. Okay, so we're going to change tone slightly, and we're going to move towards thinking about logics now rather than the representation results we've been thinking about previously. So a really quick sketch of propositional logic, just in case it's unfamiliar how these things normally operate. So propositional logic, we have a set of proposition variables, P, Q, so on and so forth. And then we combine them into formulas using connectives. So we have truth, which I'll denote by this guy, falsehood by this guy bottom, negation, conjunctions and disjunctions. And just as an example, in case this notation isn't familiar, we'd read this guy as P and not Q or R. So you know, conjunctions and disjunctions are ands and ors, if that isn't familiar terminology. Okay, so we're not really interested in propositional logic. We want to extend it to things called modal logic. So those are, from our point of view for this talk anyway, they're going to be like these propositional logics, but then extended with things called modalities or modal operators. So it's probably easiest to see these guys by example. Some modalities that we might consider is we might write box of phi to say that phi is certain in some sense. So that might mean that some agent believes that it's certain, so we can model belief, or an agent knows that it's certain. And then similarly, we could say via this diamonds, the standard notation for this particular modality, that phi is possible, which in the classical case is actually equivalent to saying it is not certain that it's not true. So these two guys are actually intimately related in the classical case. So we can model knowledge. So we could say that Alice knows that phi is true. We could say that Bob believes that phi is true. And we could go to a probabilistic setting as well and say that phi is true with probability at least p. So that's what this little p would denote down here. So I'm going to try and make this stuff more precise in a moment. This is just a sort of sketch of what a modal logic might typically look like. So an example formula, just so we can try and read one of these guys. This would say, it's possible that P holds, and it's certain that either Q or R holds. So it's fairly intuitive, at least, what they're trying to express, if not quite how the mechanics of that being expressed would work. Okay, so the reason I emphasized graphs earlier is that when we think about what these expressions mean on the previous slide, then the standard thing to consider is a thing called a Kripke frame or a Kripke structure. So it's basically a directed graph. So we've been looking at generalized directed graphs earlier, so we can hopefully see where we're going with this setup. So the idea here is we consider the box modality. So this was the certainty modality that we considered on the previous slide. Then we would say in some state x, then it's certain that phi holds if every y that we can transition to, phi holds. So I'll give an example. So we said that this meant falsehood. So logic 101 and basic intuition says that falsehood can hold nowhere. It's just not true. It's the untrue thing. So where would we expect box of falsehood to hold? Well, if we consider state x, then by this definition, we say that everywhere that we can reach from x, so that's y, falsehood must hold. But we know that falsehood can't hold. So we can reach a state from x. So basically, box of falsehood can't hold at state x. Now, we can follow a similar argument for y. In state y, we can make transitions to a couple of different states. We can either transition to y again, or we can transition to z, and we expect that falsehood holds in both of those states, which, again, it just can't do. So box of falsehood doesn't hold in either state x or state y. But now, if we look at state z, then we consider the full set of states that you can transition to from Z, well, that's the empty set. We can't transition everywhere, so anywhere. So everywhere that Z can transition to, falsehood actually does hold, because that's a trivial condition. There's nowhere we can reach. So in actual fact, box of falsehood does hold at state Z, because there's just nowhere we can go from there. So in a way, we can think of this as describing a fairly simple graph theoretic property, that there are no outbound states from the state that we're currently sitting in. 5 minutes. All right, I better accelerate. Okay, so we saw a directed graph on the previous slide, and we can describe those directed graphs as coalgebras of this form, so taking states to sets of states that we can reach in one step. We can then define the semantics for a particular formula phi as being all the states where that formula holds. So that's a fairly standard definition. You just take all the places where you consider that formula to hold. We're now going to define ourselves a natural transformation, which we're going to use these brackets. These brackets are what are called semantic brackets. We're going to say the semantics of box is given by a natural transformation of this type, which takes a set U to its power set, basically, is what that's saying. And if we do the necessary checking, then we basically see that this behavior of the box modality is equivalent to saying that the semantics of box phi is given by taking where phi holds, mapping it along this natural transformation to give all the subsets where phi holds, so subsets of states where the condition holds, and then traveling back along the inverse image of the coalgebra. So that's going to take you to states where everywhere they can reach in one step, the condition is going to hold. So that's sort of working backwards towards the semantics of the box modality in a more coalgebraic or category theoretic form. And if we now generalize that situation, so we consider an arbitrary coalgebra, so we're now considering T here rather than the power set, then if we want to define a modality of our own, Hart, then they're given by things which are called predicate liftings, which are natural transformations of this type. So that's exactly what we considered on the previous slide. But we're now allowed to pick an arbitrary one to describe the semantics of a modality. And given the predicate lifting, we then define that the semantics is given, again, as we saw on the previous slide, by taking phi and then looking at where those states are sent by our natural transformation. So they might choose to do possibility rather than certainty, or incorporate some understanding of the probabilities involved or whatever, and then map them along the dynamics, which basically encodes the specifics of the graph we're considering, and that'll give us our semantics. Okay, so in the next 5 minutes, we are going to consider, 4 minutes, we're going to consider a change of signature functor. So now what we're going to consider is the self-adjoint operators, and we're going to consider a map here for taking effectively a physical quantity to the distribution on measurement outcomes that we're going to get. So it's another natural way of describing quantum systems from the point of view of one of these signature functors. And then we mentioned here, obviously, we fixed the sort of dimension. So there's a different signature function for each dimension of Hilbert space we might want to consider. And then we define, well, for the sake of time, we're going to say the obvious coalgebra, so the one that, again, uses the Hilbert space formalism to cook up these probability distributions. Okay, and then we can define some predicate lifting. So these are these natural transformations that we're interested in. This one here basically captures the idea that for a given self-adjoint operator, measurement outcome and probability that a particular outcome state is going to have the sum of the probability of ending with that measurement outcome and in a state we want is P, basically. So the total probability of doing that measurement and getting the outcome we want has probability P. And then a completely similar thing, except here we put an inequality, basically says the probability of getting the measurement outcome that we want and a subsequently satisfying state is greater than P. This just turns out to have some nicer properties if you want to consider the logics, but we won't get into that. And it turns out that both of these sets of modalities, so there's one of these for each PR and A that we'd want to consider, they form what's called a separating set, which means that they're able as a whole to distinguish states up to behavioral equivalence. So that's quite a nice thing. If you've got two different states your logic is able to tell them apart if you write sufficiently interesting formulae. And this property is referred to as expressivity. So we've got an expressive logic for our co-algebraic setting for quantum systems. Okay, so this I'm going to bomb through faster than I intended. So if we start with a co-algebra gamma on a signature functor T, then we can extend that to a co-algebra on T prime using a natural transformation of appropriate type. And it turns out that that's actually functorial. So we can map co-algebras on T to co-algebras on T prime, and we just leave the morphisms as they are, because this still commutes by naturality. You can paste these two diagrams together. So we have a functor alpha star taking T co-algebras to T prime co-algebras. And what that lets us do is introduce a new type of modality. So these are not the ones using predicate liftings. Instead, we're going to exploit this mapping we saw on the previous slide to be able to say after alpha, whatever that might mean, phi holds is the same thing as saying that phi holds if we map the co-algebra over by this functor that we've considered on the previous slide. So the idea here is that you're saying that if we adapt our original co-algebra using this natural transformation, then after that, phi is going to hold. And loosely, this looks similar to what you might do with the existential and universal quantifiers in predicate logic. They kind of change the context in which you're reasoning about a particular statement, because they're going to squash a free variable, basically, in your formula that you're considering, which I haven't got time to make clearer. Okay, so reason for considering that is if we consider the distribution-based signature functor that we were interested in, then our unitaries are going to give us a map from self-adjoints to self-adjoints. And similarly to how we did things before, we can pre-compose with these guys, and that's going to give us a Heisenberg-style evolution on this new signature functor that we're interested in, so that we can write, and it works in the way that you would hope, after unitary U, condition phi holds. So it's a way of describing unitaries in this logical setting. And similarly, using the same infrastructure, if we consider a two-qubit system and take the linear map that sort of projects out the relevant component, we then take inverse images, then that's going to give us a map from self-adjoints to self-adjoints again, but from two different dimensions of Hilbert space. And if we pre-compose with those maps, then we get a map which we're going to call Alice, which takes us from this signature functor to the signature functor of the smaller system. And this, it turns out, allows us to write, if I restrict to Alice's qubit, then condition phi holds. So that allows us to sort of localize statements to subsystems of a larger quantum system using this trick with this functor that gets introduced by natural transformations. Right, very quickly, I'll just bomb through these. We're going to introduce some extra modalities. One p hat here, which basically says projective measurement p is certain to succeed. This guy here says if I get measurement outcome r for this self-adjoint operator, then the subsequent condition is certain to hold. And then we can combine these guys together. So we say if we measure this observable, then if I get this measurement outcome, this holds. If this measurement outcome, this holds, and so on. So those are just useful glue that I won't make clear what exactly they mean. Okay. Similarly to what we did with the natural transformations a minute ago, if we've got a predicate lifting, so this is a thing that gives us a semantics for one of these modalities, we can, using a natural transformation, glue that guy on the end, and we get a new natural transformation, which also is a predicate lifting, if you check the types on the ends here. And that's a predicate lifting that we'll denote by the original one to the alpha, basically, for want of a better notation. And this technical trick also turns out to be useful, because we remember this Alice map that we had previously that took us from the four-dimensional system to the two-dimensional system, so from two qubits to one qubit. Then we also had this projective measurement P is certain to have a positive outcome. We consider that on the one-qubit system, then P raised to the Alice basically says this projective measurement is certain to succeed on Alice's qubit. So again, it allows us to localize statements that we're making about the system, but on a sort of per modality basis. This gives us a sort of local measurement, basically, via this construction. Okay, and then let's skip that, that's technical. Finally, down to an example. So I'm pretty much done, Bill, if you're thinking you have to kill me off. This is basically quantum teleportation written out using the infrastructure that we've just built up. So this basically says Alice's qubit is in state phi, the channel is in the Bell state. If I perform a measurement in the Bell basis, then depending on the measurement outcome, Bob can localize to his qubit, apply a correcting unitary, and he gets the state that was originally in Alice's qubit to start off with. So we've formalized all of that using these modalities that we've been constructing. And we can break things up in a sort of more post-selecting style. So basically, this guy is a big conjunction under the hood just glued together, so we can consider each of the different components. So we can just basically say, again, the initial state is as we expect. We've got a state for Alice and a Bell state on the channel. We perform the appropriate measurement, and if we get outcome I, then Bob can apply correction I, and he gets the state that he wants as the output. So it's kind of post-selecting it that we're only considering one measurement and outcome here. Okay, conclusion. So basically, I think that modeling of state-based systems is a pretty mature field in the computer science literature. But I think that these guys have got something to offer for modeling of physical systems. Quantum systems are what I've considered, but I think in general, physical systems kind of look of this type. You can prod them around, they have states, and they have observations that you can make on them. So it seems that there's something that can be done there. And there isn't a lot that's been done so far, so I think there's quite a lot of scope for innovating and doing new and hopefully interesting things. Okay, thank you.
Questions?
Well, you talked about a few different modalities, the necessity, possibility, and true some probability.
Yeah.
There's been some work in the last few years in quantum foundations on talking just about possibilistic theories where you don't specify the probabilities, you just specify whether the probability is zero or not. And I suppose you could also sort of imagine specifying when the probability is one or zero or something in between.
Yeah.
So that suggests that if you started with a model that had a modality of, you know, this is true with some probability, then there would be something like a functor onto a model that was just the possibility and necessity.
Yeah, I think you could do that. Yeah, so I've not thought of it that way, but I've achieved sort of similar effects by just restricting the modalities that you use, because obviously you've got the full spectrum, you know, the ones for arbitrary probabilities, and then you can just say, divide them into two types, the one that says this has got no chance, and other, yeah, that this is possible. So you've kind of got the modalities that you need with the ones I described. So one thing you could just do is some syntactic sugars rather than any complicated transformation.
It's sometimes interesting to ask what are the possibilistic predictions of a probabilistic theory.
Well, the other thing
that you really want to lump all of the cases where there's some probability that isn't zero into a possibilistic.
Yeah. I think, well, if I was going to do that just logically, so just with the modalities, I think my first instinct would probably not to introduce some functor, but simply to consider some syntactic sugar that captures that those modalities that are built out of the previous modalities. But if it was maybe interested in a bit more structure, then I might be tempted to transform that cardioboy we considered for the representation result in the first half into a sort of possibilistic form and then see what happens there, because then I think I would be tempted to introduce some functor from probabilistic land to possibilistic land and see what happens in between. But, you know, I've not considered that yet, but I think in that case, the functor between the two sounds like the right thing then. Probably induced by one of these natural transformations that does the relevant squashing would be the right thing.
I remember there were some subtleties about this. Ben Schumacher and Michael Westmoreland wrote a paper on modal quantum theory.
Yeah.
And I vaguely remember there being sort of two notions in which, two ways in which the probability could be zero, and they took one of them to still be possible. But I can't remember exactly what that subtlety was.
So that I'll definitely try and look at, because you don't want to get tripped up by somebody else's subtlety, certainly.
Any other questions?
Yep. Is there a simple way of defining types of products of coalgebra? So like a symmetric one out of bi functor of the category?
I think not without more assumptions. I think you could, for the coalgebras specific to the quantum case,
right,
you could obviously do
right.
the obvious thing.
Yeah.
But if you think about all the other coalgebras that are living in there, there's basically a load of stupid ones that don't do anything interesting. And then there may well be other ones that you might want to consider. For instance, I don't know if it's possible to sort of model a PR box in some way as another type of coalgebra, and then what the heck its state space would look like, if that's even possible. I'm not sure. And similarly, you could consider ones that behave classically or in some other pathological way. And then you'd have to define a sort of tensor product that would cope with all of that variety, and it's pretty ad hoc. So it's not obvious to me you could define a tensor product that was useful, that would behave as the quantum one in the quantum case and sort of extended usefully to the other cases. It would be cool if you could, but I'm not sure it's practical without restricting to sort of the quantum specific. It's certainly not known that it's impossible, but intuitively it seems difficult without introducing other assumptions on how the thing should behave. Yeah, yeah. I think that's the picture. Yeah, not known to be hard.
It's not certain that it's not.
Yeah.
So it's possible.
It's possible. Yeah, possible, not certain. Yeah.
Anyone else?
So, just a slightly subtle point when you have these state transitions. It's a very projective setup. So how do you deal with the situation that sometimes you may go into a mixed state and you trace out Bob, for example?
So that's something I didn't mention in the slides. But from there's sort of two ways to look at mixed states. Two ways I look at mixed states. There's the mixed state that is, I pressed a button on my quantum system, it moved to some subsequent state. I then banged my head and forgot what the state was. So there's some probability as to which button I pressed, which is probably not the most interesting of the two cases. The other case is I'm looking at a 2-qubit system. It's in the Bell state. I trace out my left qubit, and then I look at that. It's in some mixed state, basically, because the whole thing's entangled, which seems, I don't know, physically, I think that sounds more interesting to me than the banged head scenario. But algebraically, instead, with the setup I've got, you don't really need to do the mixed states and the tracing out. Instead, what you do is these. Yep. Where are we? Yeah, so this guy here. So we're doing a projective measurement, but we're doing it via this sort of Aliceifying thing. So this is saying do the projective measurement on Alice's qubit in a 2-qubit system, and you'll get measurement predictions that are consistent with as if it's in a mixed state. But in reality, you're dealing with a CalGebra that's only dealing with pure states, basically. So it's as if you look through a window on the system, it looks at one half, and effectively it's going to look like a mixed state, but it isn't. It's because the larger pure state system is simulating the mixedness.
All right.
Cool. Thank you.